On Monster Talk, we frequently talk about imaginary monsters or creatures of folklore. But today, we will be discussing a real creature that preys on humans and our closest animal companions. It is often invisible. It drinks blood to survive. And it is responsible for many of the sightings credited to a chupacabra. Many of you will cringe and recoil in horror when you learn the true facts behind the creature known as Sarcoptes scabii.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and together with Dr. Karen Stolzno, blogger, linguist, and paranormal researcher, and Benjamin Radford, science journalist and managing editor of Skeptical Inquirer, we fish for the chunky pieces of science in the steaming bowl of soup that is monster folklore. Today, we find some especially meaty pieces as we get under the skin of the Chupacabra legend and find out more about the lice that cause the often reported hairless canids the media seems to love so much. It's okay to scratch, but don't skip this episode. Once you get past the disgust factor, there is some amazing science going on in acarology, and it is fascinating stuff.
Monster Talk.
So, I noticed the other day that we've actually been doing Monster Talk for a full year now. It's kind of fantastic.
Happy birthday to us.
Yaha. So, this is the first opportunity we've had to get together. Actually, we had an opportunity to be together, but nobody noticed it was the one-year anniversary while we were there.
What date marks the anniversary?
It was about, I guess, a couple of days before we actually went live with episode one, which would have been in July of 2009. So, wow. The specific date, I'll look it up, and then we can put that on our webpage.
All right. So, we're well over one now.
Yeah. So...
And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, haven't we recently achieved a milestone in terms of listeners?
Yep, we've crossed the 10,000 subscribers milestone. So it was very close to my one-year goal. I don't know what my goal is for year two. I'd like to get a Nobel Prize winner on. How about that?
Can it be an Ig Nobel or does it have to be Nobel?
Either one would do in my book. I would, you know...
Yeah, if we're going to have doctors and believers, then we'll have to have both.
I'd love to get an Ig Nobel Prize myself. I haven't really published.
You're well on the way.
Yeah. Well, you have to do something real science-y. It just has to be crazy. So,
science-y.
Real science-y. I'll leave that off the show. We'll talk about that offline. My plans to get an Ig Nobel Prize. So.
Has it got something to do with mites?
It's something to do with bones. I think there's something to do with Bigfoot bones.
And Bigfoot, all right. Yeah.
So there's that.
So what's today's topic, Dr. Atlantis?
Today's topic, we're going to be talking about a real monster, one that you can actually encounter in the woods near your home if you live in North America, and probably... all over the world, as a matter of fact. This is a blood-sucking creature that looks very strange.
It's not a chupacabra?
No, but it is directly related
to a vampire?
No, it's not a vampire either. These are all good guesses. No, today we're going to talk about lice.
Lice?
I'm itchy already.
Lice and mites. We're going to talk about the creatures that cause the hairless... canines that we see on the media so frequently that people attribute to being chupacabras. So we're going to be talking to Dr. Barry O'Connor, who is an evolutionary parasitologist, and he actually specializes in mites, including the kinds that cause mange. And mange is probably the most common cause for the hairless condition we see in, let's call them media chupacabra candidates, Or being, Ben, you may have some other shorthand for them. I'm not sure.
I usually call them temporary chupacabras.
I like that, temporary chupacabra.
Nice. <Yes.
laughs> What's that in Spanish, Ben?
Chupacabras temporalidades.
Oh, I like that. That sounds very exotic.
Very, very romantic.
¿Dónde está la chupacabra or el chupacabra?
It would probably be L, but
It's funny.
So what are some of the other causes if we're not talking mites and mange?
Apparently there's a breed of dog that's naturally hairless, or not a dog. What is the, maybe it is a dog.
What's the Zolo's a dog, sure.
The Zolo's a dog. And then there's those hairless, there was the red wolf coyote hybrid they found. And that was also hairless, but I'm not really sure if that was a genetic condition or if that was parasitism here.
The hairless cats as well?
Right. Yeah, there are. There are.
There's, of course, also alopecia.
That's true. And what's he got to do with it? No.
Alopecia. He makes great pizza down in Chicago.
I thought he was Irish. Yeah.
No, that's a different one. That's his brother.
So
we were talking about alopecia.
We were. I had a friend in college who had alopecia, and it was completely hairless.
It doesn't always result in complete loss of hair, though.
No, it does not.
It can be patches of hair loss. I know that's common with some thyroid conditions.
That's right.
And temporary, usually. It
can be.
I was just listening to the Science Show from Australia, and they had a bit with Sir David Attenborough talking about sort of what are eyebrows for, and it was interesting because he talked about how that pattern baldness is obviously a trait that's not being prevented by evolution, I guess. So having hair on your head late in life doesn't appear to be an important evolutionary trait one way or the other. But eyebrows rarely go away, and so he was looking at why we have eyebrows. It's very interesting.
What about Whoopi Goldberg?
I don't know. Does she not have eyebrows?
I've never seen eyebrows on that woman.
Women pluck them for fashion reasons.
Completely? Like Whoopi?
Well, I think not usually completely, but some get tattoos. So
that's
if they
true.
Overpluck
that's
them
true.
And then they don't grow back, then they end up getting them tattooed on, which I don't think looks very good.
That
it's not very
creepy.
Convincing.
No. Wow. I guess, is there a – I mean, it wouldn't be a merkin. What would it be for the eyebrows?
What would it be? For the, what?
I said it wouldn't be a merkin, which I know that you two are familiar with, but what would it be for eyebrows?
What would it be for eyebrows?
A toupee for the eyebrows.
Oh, I see.
Oh.
Come on, work with me here, folks.
What would a toupee for the eyebrows be? No, it would definitely not be a merkin.
We do have two merkins on the show today, but in one Aussie.
You know what? No, that's a good word. And instead of defining it, let's let people look it up. Because it's,
there we go. Yes.
If you're over 18, feel free to look up merkin.
We're very highbrow here.
To do with eyebrow. Yeah, highbrow eyebrows.
Yeah, that's rather lowbrow if you follow me.
I've been thinking.
Yeah, I don't know. Like Karen just said, I think most people just, paint them on or tattoo them on.
Well, you pencil them in. Or
pencil
something.
Them. And me, I just keep trimming mine before they take over and become my new top hat. I mean, I've got like...
You've got a monobrow.
It's not even. It wants to like crawl over the top of my head. It's like, I feel like I could be the skeptical Stanton Friedman, and that's saying something. Because that man's got some eyebrows.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're alien, but they're very powerful.
Speaking of nits and mites, I may be mistaken, but I think that the phrase nitpicking, if I'm not mistaken, it comes from the eggs of mites and lice, which you can find in children's heads and whatnot. And that's where the idea of nitpicking, looking for little tiny details, is people would of course pick these eggs and lice out of like children's hair, for example.
Yeah,
chimpanzees.
I wasn't sure. I thought it just referred to the lice themselves, but I know monkeys, as part of their grooming, like to pick the lice off. And I'm not sure if they're eating it. I assume they are, or at least crushing it with their teeth.
And what else would they do with them?
Well, they could just kill them. I mean,
collect them.
Well, like dogs bite the fleas or
put them on eBay.
Well, I don't think if they look like Jesus. They actually. I don't know what else they would do with them. I'm just saying that I guess they could throw them. Well, I don't know. Okay, just never mind. Fine, whatever.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I'm just asking.
They could have been pinching them or squishing them. I don't know. You know, those.
I think that's the point, isn't it? A bonding thing.
Well, I think the point is just to get the nits off of you. You know what I mean?
And bond.
I mean, yeah, I think the bonding's evolved as an important social behavior among primates. You know, and I know when my wife combs my back hair and looks for nits, I really appreciate it.
That's very sweet.
Leave that in.
And what do you do for her in return?
I have high serotonin levels, and I make loud noises that make her feel part of the pack.
And you paint on her eyebrows.
Troop. Part of the troop. We're primates, so.
That's so romantic. Your wife's a lucky, lucky woman, Blake.
Everyone's laughing, and their tin hats are falling off. What? No, that's probably the least gross thing we'll talk about today, honestly, is my back.
Oh. I'm off, really. I get freaked out about this sort of stuff.
No, mites are disgusting. Mites and lice. And
well, they're things you can't see. I mean, it's Howard Hughes, isn't it?
Well, you can certainly sense when you're actually infected. And I'm not going to talk about what I know. Let's let the expert talk about it. But from my familiarity with the topic.
Have we got personal stories of infestations?
No. Not personally. We were public schools here in the South, and I imagine this is true nationwide, but every now and then a school will get a lice outbreak, and then the next thing you know, you're putting on the special shampoo for your kids or shaving your kids' heads. That means, you know, actually taking baths and all kinds of breaks to the normal routine around here.
I had them once when I was about 8 years old. There was an outbreak in school, and having long hair, they spread very quickly. So I remember having the special bath.
Yeah?
They dip you in like Achilles or something? Or
no. I just remember Mum washing my hair and having to comb them out and comb the eggs out and dead creatures, and it wasn't very pleasant.
Wow. So you can imagine how uncomfortable it would be for wildlife. I know one of my first big skeptical investigations that I did for anybody besides myself was looking into the Jacobs creature, which was a bear photo. Well, okay. It was a photo of an animal in Pennsylvania a couple of years ago. And the bear experts said it was a mangy bear, but the Bigfoot aficionados or enthusiasts believed it was probably some sort of primate. And it really, to me, it highlighted one of the big issues with unusual photos of animals, especially mammals. And that's that in support of the evolutionary theory, right? We look a lot alike when we don't have hair. All of us, all these little animals look quite similar. And even like at a skeletal level, if you have a carcass, you know, if you're not an expert, it can be hard to tell from a partial skeleton what an animal is. And in this case, you know, you had a big animal. You had lots of pictures of bears and then these strange photos that look kind of like a bear, maybe something else. Some people thought they looked nothing like a bear. And part of that, I was looking at, you know, why was mange affecting these animals? So I did a lot of research on mange at the time. And it's just pretty prevalent. I think it was you, Ben, that came up with the idea that, or at least first brought to my attention the idea that we'll probably be seeing more mangy animals because with milder winters, they'll be able to survive the winter better. So we might be seeing more of these kind of strange-looking animals. I'm not sure if that's true because now we've had some harsh winters again. I don't know, but
I researched mange a fair amount for my Chupacabra book coming out early next year, and I ended up tracking down mange experts and you know getting some really interesting information that a lot of people apparently just had no, particularly the Chupacabra proponents, or at least the temporary Chupacabra proponents. Really sort of didn't seem to have a clue about. So this will be interesting.
I don't want to dominate the conversation, but I'll tell you one other thing that I noticed that I had I don't want to call it a bias. I had some kind of a idea that maybe the reason these animals were being misidentified. When I looked at these animals and saw hairless animals, I saw hairless dogs, hairless anything seems to make people think monster for some reason.
This is not typical.
Right, they are atypical, but you know that they're not a different species just because they don't have hair necessarily, right? So whatever they are, I thought it was unusual. I thought maybe the problem was that these are animals that are being spotted by people from urban areas, and they're just not familiar with what wildlife looks like. And I thought, well, that makes good sense. I got this idea in my head that maybe it would be like the city folk, problem, that city folk don't know how to identify animals. But it turns out a lot of these animals are being identified by people from rural areas. The woman from Texas who had the hairless dogs in her yard, what's her name again, Ben? The woman who rides around on the tractor?
Phyllis Canyon.
Phyllis Canyon, thank you. It was just
Cuero, Texas.
Yeah, so Phyllis Canyon, for example, she's a rancher. You know, she's familiar with what animals are out there. So that was wrong. It's not a country folk, city folk, urban, rural problem. It's just a classical inability to identify an animal that looks different from what you expect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that same kind of mistake is probably behind, and I'm going to say Bigfoot, some of the Bigfoot sightings where people see a bear that's not behaving like a normal bear or looks somewhat different or standing on its hind legs. And they don't see a bear. You know, they see something unusual that's not what they expect. And they're sure, if they don't know what it is, but they're sure it's not a bear.
Yeah, I guess it's not encountering an animal in that sort of form. So that's all that is. It's not going to be a common thing. I mean, how common is this? I guess we'll find out today
for
creatures to be affected by mites and mange. And I'm still itching.
Just thinking of it?
Yeah.
Just the thoughts of it.
Don't you guys?
No.
Well, you know,
I just got groomed, though.
you just had your back waxed.
That's right.
You know,
not that I'm needing a grooming.
Well, you know, there's definitely a psychosomatic element to it. Not that anyone's imagining it, but you know, if you start thinking about bugs and creepy crawlies and weird things in the bed, it's very easy to sort of convince yourself.
There was a study, I don't know if it was in Scientific American, but it was about the psychological nature of itching. We'll have to track down the study if you want to mention it, point people to it.
Yeah.
But it was how there is definitely a psychological element to it.
Surely.
Well, speaking of that, let me throw in a plug for an excellent horror film that came out a couple of years back called Bug. It was directed by William Friedkin. Most people probably know him for The Exorcist, although I think his best film is a film called Sorcerer, which came out a couple years back, badly overlooked. But Bug, it stars Ashley Judd, and it's a fascinating, it's very, very realistic from a psychological point of view, depiction of how people can sort of believe that they're being infested, and sort of you have what the French call folie à deux. In which you have two people who are sharing a belief system, and it's sort of a mild form of mass hysteria. So it's a withdrawal
symptom,
right? Yeah, you never know. But it is a good scary film, and it's very, again, it's very realistic from a psychological point of view.
Yeah, you talk about folie à deux in your book, Scientific Paranormal Investigation, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And I was just thinking, is that similar to a shared delusion? Like, does that cover cases like where, one that I remember recently, where a woman thought she was a divine. I don't remember if she thought she was Jesus reincarnated or something, but her husband was going along with it.
Mm-hmm.
Does that cover that kind of case?
Yeah, it's very similar to that. What you find is that you have one. It's not just it's often just two people, but it can actually be larger groups. Usually, a handful, maybe no more than a dozen or so. But usually, it's just two or three people, and usually they're related by blood or marriage. Or close relationship.
Or both.
If you're in Georgia, who knows? Or in Sydney. But that's usually the circumstances. And so one person will get the idea that they have, that they're afflicted by something. They either have something bothering them, or they have some sort of special ability, or they're having some unusual, unique experience. And it's always something that is, it's really on the borderline between clearly true and clearly not true. I mean, that is, you know, if a person claims that, you know, that they're being attacked by, you know, a Bigfoot, then obviously that's not true. But if a person believes they're being attacked by something that's small or invisible or hard to detect, then that, then to certainly another person who will begin to buy into that, that could be very believable.
Monster Talk.
Today we're calling Dr. Barry O'Connor, evolutionary parasitologist who specializes in mites, and you're also a medical veterinary acarologist.
Acarologist, right. That's a person who studies mites and ticks.
Excellent. All right, well, we're calling today because, mostly because we want to talk about mites, mange, lice, and scabies, and parasites. And the tie-in to monsters is that a lot of times these hairless animals, like dogs and coyotes, are being found and called a monster. And it turns out that later that they've actually got a condition called mange. So can you tell our listeners what mange is exactly?
Well, mange is a skin condition, and we usually use the word when we're talking about animals rather than people. People get in some cases, the same kinds of mite parasites can attack both people and animals, but in humans, we don't call it mange. In animals, generally what happens is you get rather large populations of mites. That's not generally the case in humans, although there are variants on the human condition that resemble what happens with mange in animals. But what happens is you get lots of mites burrowing in the skin, and this is the normal thing that they do. That is their life cycle, and that elicits an immune response on the part of the host, either a human or an animal, and that usually takes the form of inflammation. That can lead to thickening of the skin. The mites will often be burrowing in just the upper layer of the skin, but that will become quite thickened. That will cause blood loss to the hair follicles, and so the hair actually will fall out. And this can be either very generalized over the whole body or just in parts. And oftentimes, in particularly bad cases, you will have secondary bacterial infections of the skin that will give the suffering animal a very bad odor. And in many cases, this can be fatal in animals.
What's the name for human mange then, or does that take different forms?
Well, actually, the mite that we're talking about that's causing most of these cases of complete hair loss and, you know, this chupacabra syndrome, if you want to call it that, is a mite called Sarcoptes scabii. And in humans, the medical condition is called scabies. It's a rather common skin disorder. It does tend to run in kind of epidemics, in that you will have high incidence of scabies in a particular population. And then as most of those individuals recover, because in humans, it's generally a self-limiting condition. Your immune system will ultimately kill off the mites. And when it does that, then pretty much you're going to be immune to reinfection for the rest of your life. And so when a population grows up who's never been exposed to the mite, and then the mite gets brought into that population, it can spread easily through the susceptible individuals, who will then recover ultimately and be immune, and then the epidemic will be over in that area. The same thing happens. I mean, it's the same mite can cause, and it's one of the main causes of mange in mammals, and, you know, both domestic and in some wild mammals. One of the things that we've done here is to, you know, do some morphological work showing that the Sarcoptes mite on humans is the same mite that's on animals. This had been previously hypothesized back in the 1960s, but using modern methods, we have verified that is the case. And what appears to have happened is that as humans domesticated animals, this mite, which is really ancestrally a human parasite. I did some work many years ago, and this was followed up by some work done by a student of mine, Hans Klumpen, who's now down at Ohio State University, showing that Sarcoptes mite actually has been with our species, that is the humans, from the outset. The closest relatives of this mite occur on our closest relatives and on back through the primate lineage. So it looks like the Sarcoptes mites and their relatives have evolved with the primates. And then when we get the people, because the mites are transmitted by direct contact, they really can't live too long away from a host. And so, as soon as people started having close contact with animals, especially the livestock as we domesticated those species, with dogs particularly, the mite was able to transfer over onto those species. And as is generally the case, whenever you have, what you can consider a new host parasite association, it's pretty nasty. We call it highly virulent. It does a lot of damage, and mortality can be relatively high because it's a new situation that, that host species has not had any evolutionary history with that parasite, so it has not been able to evolve any defenses, like we have, okay, because it's been sort of our mite all along, and, we have, what we say co-evolved with it so that in humans, normal scabies is an annoyance, okay, it makes you itch, but like I said, it's self-limiting, it will go away, and, you're not the worse for wear, whereas in animals, you will get these, enormous populations. What's happened subsequent to the transfer from humans onto domestic animals is that apparently the dogs then have taken it out into populations of their relatives, the wild canids like coyotes and foxes and wolves, and they get it, and they get it really bad. And then some of them have even taken it further into other mammal populations. There's a particularly bad condition in Australia with the Sarcoptes mite killing off wombats, which they presumably got the mite from the dingoes who, got them from the domestic dogs who got them from us.
I've seen cases of that before. It looks really nasty.
But what is the typical pattern for hair loss in animals with advanced stages of mange? And I've seen quite a few of them in researching the chupacabra, but some of them seem to be completely hairless. Other ones just seem to have some crest on the back. Can you sort of give us a typical pattern for that?
Well, I don't know if you can say there is a typical pattern for sarcoptic mange. I've done a little more work with some related mites that parasitize rodents. They're in the same family as Sarcoptes. There's one we have here in squirrels, and the squirrel mange is very characteristic because the hair loss is almost always restricted to the anterior part of the body. So. And not even the entire head. So it's sort of from the top of the head back to sort of mid-body and then kind of down to the elbows. And the rest of the body tends to remain, completely furred. And, of course, there are exceptions to this, but that's the common pattern that you see with squirrel mange. Some of the others, will normally attack just around the ears. There's mites that attacks cats. Cats don't seem to be all that susceptible to sarcoptic mange. They do get it, but it's pretty rare. There's another mite called Notoedris that Notoedris cati is the species that attacks cats, and also it's apparently transferred from cats to rabbits because it will parasitize rabbits, and it also occurs in the wild in the old world tropics on civets and mongooses and things like that. Okay, and that one really likes the feet and the again the face where you get this thickening of the skin again and some hair loss, but you don't typically see the kind of generalized hair loss that you see with Sarcoptes in dogs.
And what actually determines whether or not mange develops? Does every case of this kind of parasite potentially cause mange, or how does that work?
Yes. Yeah. When you get the mite on its normal host, which in the case of Sarcoptes would be a human, and on humans, the normal place where the mites actually burrow into the skin is on the extremities, so very typically on the hands, okay, occasionally the feet, sometimes the genitalia. So scabies can be a sexually transmitted disease. And because humans aren't very well furred, you know, we don't notice any, you know, any kind of hair loss because we didn't have much to begin with. They don't tend to attack on the head. There is a condition in humans that's called crusted scabies that really does kind of mimic what goes on in these bad cases of sarcoptic mange in animals. Because a normal case of scabies in humans, the population size of the mites is anywhere from 20 to 30 mites, and which isn't very many. But in these cases of so-called crusted scabies, you will get hundreds of thousands of mites, and you know maybe even millions of mites that can you know spread all over the body. And with that condition, you get this thickening of the skin and all the things that go along with the condition we see in other mammal species. For a long time, people wondered about this crusted scabies condition and thought, well, maybe it's a different kind of mite. But now we know that it's actually exactly the same mite. It's just that the people are different. The people who get this crusted scabies condition have a compromised immune system. So it's most common in the elderly. It's common in AIDS patients and in people who have had organ transplants and have had immunosuppressive therapy. And one of the key tests of the fact that it really is the same mite is that in a medical setting, when people with crusted scabies are being treated, very often the physicians and nurses that are treating them will come down with a case of normal scabies if they hadn't been previously exposed.
Barry, I wanted to ask you a question. It might be a silly question, but is there a connection between chickenpox and scabies at all, or do people confuse the appearance of the two?
Well, there's no connection. Chickenpox is caused by a virus, but you know, in both cases, the initial lesion that you will see on the skin is going to be a reddish raised papule that will be very itchy. And you know all of that comes as a result of the immune response, and in one case it's a response to the virus in the skin, and on the other it's a response to the antigens that are present in the mites.
So there's a similarity in the appearance then.
Right, scabies mites are actually going to be literally burrowing in the skin, and they make little burrows that run parallel to the surface of the skin. One of the classic diagnostic methods for diagnosing scabies in the absence of actually seeing a mite is to put some ink on the skin around the lesion and then you know let it soak in and then wipe it off the surface. And okay. Ink will be actually taken up into the burrow, and you'll see these little lines then on the skin that mark the path that the mite has taken.
I just wanted to say gross.
Yeah, I know.
That's what I was thinking.
You.
Well, if you want, I can tell you about one of the grossest pictures I ever saw at a scientific meeting.
That's saying something.
Please,
coming from
ahead.
You.
Yeah, don't deny our listeners after that tease.
We're ready.
Well, no, I went to a conference many years ago where the topic was, you know, mites of human medical importance, and a physician was giving a presentation on sexual transmission of scabies, and the only photograph that he showed, which was sort of behind him on the screen for the entire 10 minutes of his talk, was this human penis with a scabies mite burrow going up it. Okay, and of course it was you know like 10 feet tall. And anyway,
nice,
good times.
Yeah, right.
Use that for the show notes, hey?
There you go. See if you can find that.
Make sure we get a copy of that. Right.
Is mange sometimes fatal, or is it really a secondary infection?
Well, it's hard to say, you know, one way or another with animal mange. Again, one of the things about this, you know, history aspect, the mite having really had a long period of coevolution with humans, and then when we look at animal mange, dogs appear to have had it longer than some of the other species. Dogs and pigs, perhaps, because both suffer from it, but you know, it's not necessarily fatal in dogs and pigs, and they can often actually fight it off as opposed to dying from it. But then when you get out into the wild mammal populations, it's almost invariably fatal. And, you know, it can really do very serious damage to the wild populations. Years ago, when I was a graduate student in at Cornell University in New York, back in the 1970s, there was a major, what we call an epizootic, of sarcoptic mange in the red foxes there. And the mortality was, you know, between 98 and 99%. So it almost drove the foxes to extinction. And there was even talk among the wildlife biologists in the state of actually trying to trap the few remaining ones and you know, kill them and then just go find some foxes somewhere else and reintroduce, you know, basically completely mange-free animals. I don't think they did that. You know, like I say, it does tend to run in epizootics, and it did take, you know, some time for the population of hosts to rebound from, you know, from that attack.
Why is it that mange is sometimes fatal?
Well, you know, I can't tell you whether it's the infection or just the hyperimmune response, you know, the fact that all the body's energy is going towards, you know, fighting off these invaders. And you know, animals that have mange are clearly weakened by it. During an epizootic of squirrel mange that we had again back when I was in graduate school, and this is something I personally observed, but it's also been reported in the literature of literally squirrels falling from the trees, you know, because they have succumbed. Or they're just unable to, you know, they're so weak they can't hold on. And I even did a kind of an informal little bit of data collecting that I never published because it wasn't that rigorous. But you know, just going out and looking at roadkill then comparing the incidence of obvious mange conditions in the dead squirrels that I would find on the road, and compared that with the incident that I could observe in live squirrels just by, you know, walking around town. And, you know, the incidence in the dead squirrels was considerably higher than I could observe in the live ones, which, you know, suggested that, you know, if you were suffering from mange, you weren't as able to dodge cars as well as if you were completely healthy.
That makes sense.
Barry, could you possibly tell us about the life cycle of the mange-causing parasite?
Well, again, if we're talking about Sarcoptic scabii, they start as an egg, so the females lay eggs in their burrows, and what hatches from the egg is a stage what we call the larva. In the mites, the larva actually, you know, mites are arachnids, okay, like spiders and scorpions. And so arachnids are different from insects in that they have four pairs of legs instead of three, right, and they don't have antennae. Well, the mites and ticks, the acari, as we call them, are almost unique among all the arachnids in that the first life stage that hatches from the egg has only three pairs of legs. Okay, so it's like an insect in that respect. They haven't got their last pair of legs yet, and so we distinguish that stage by calling it the larva. And so the larva will live for you know, couple of days or so, and then they will molt to what we call the nymphal stage, or the nymph. Nymphs get their last pair of legs. Okay, so now they have eight legs. The mange mites have two nymphal stages. We call them the proto-nymph, or the first nymph, and then the trito-nymph, or third nymph, and you will ask me what happened to the second one. The free-living ancestors of a very large group of parasitic mites that includes these mange mites have a specialized deuto-nymph, or second nymph, that serves to disperse the species. And when these the ancestral species became a full-time parasite, they didn't need this special dispersing form anymore, so they just don't do it anymore. We can tell morphologically that the second nymphal stage is the tritonymph in the parasitic mites. so after that, then they become adult. Males and females look rather different. They do have direct mating, so the males and females have to get together. And after mating, the females are capable of laying eggs then, starting the cycle over again.
So the whole set of nymphs, are they nymphomaniacs?
I have never heard that. I'll have to write that down and give you credit for it.
Okay, thanks.
I think you mean blame.
Yeah.
How is mange diagnosed? Is the sort of thing that a layperson can just sort of look at it and say, well, it doesn't have any hair, it must be mange, or is it something that really requires closer inspection?
No, I mean, the conclusive diagnosis is you have to see the mite. And so, you know, if we're talking about a domestic dog or a cow or a pig, a veterinarian would do a scraping of the skin. Generally, this is done with the backside of a scalpel, and not the sharp side, because you don't want to cut into the skin. You just want to kind of scrape the skin, put that material then into just mineral oil or something, and look at it on a microscope slide. And, then if you see the mites, well, you have a positive diagnosis. I mean, there are other things that can cause hair loss. The general term for hair loss is alopecia. And, there's, again, a lot of causes for that, so it's not necessarily going to be a mite. And also, there's something I noticed in looking at the squirrel mange, is that many of the animals that I looked at, these were roadkill, I couldn't find mites on them. And yet they showed the very characteristic pattern of hair loss that I described for you. And so it looks like what happened there was that those individuals had, in fact, been able to clear the infection, that their immune system had killed off all the mites. But they didn't grow their hair back immediately, and because the hair loss tended to occur in the fall of the year, these animals would be sort of half naked all winter long, and again, that would seriously weaken them. And the normal pattern of molting in squirrels, would have them then grow their new, spring and summer coat in the springtime. And if they did survive and get rid of the mites, they would grow a new, a new coat in the springtime, and, they would look fully furred again, and not really show any signs of the mange. But, I remember looking, the first few squirrels I looked at, there weren't any mites there. And I was, wondering about, what could be causing this. But then I started to actually find them, where I could, I could actually find the mites, and that was that.
Are most parasites, their host species specific? Is that correct?
Well, I would say most of them are, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of them that aren't. The sarcoptic mange mite or scabies mite is one of those that, if humans had never become humans and never domesticated other species, that mite probably would not have ever, had the opportunity to get onto and establish itself on some other host. The few cases, again, this code goes back to Hans Klomphen's evolutionary work that he did with these. He was able to show that host switches in the entire family Sarcoptidae are fairly rare, but he could point to several cases of clear host switches where, closely related mite species don't occur on closely related hosts. And since the most of the species in the mange mite family, Sarcoptidae, are parasites on bat, there's a few cases where species have moved from one of the major groups of bats onto the other one, and there's some cases where they've moved from bats onto rodents that live in the trees. So the squirrel mange mite, which now really lives only on squirrels, has an ancestry that goes back to bat hosts. And there's a few that are on mice and rats as well, but these are often found on arboreal species.
I read a few years ago about the relationship between gorilla lice and human genital lice. And I was wondering, what can the genetics of parasites tell us about the evolution of the host animals?
Well, there's a long, interesting history in parasitology about what we call coevolutionary patterns. And if you go back 100 years, it was generally thought that you know, every parasite was host specific, and that every parasite had sort of evolved with its host. Okay, and so you could use then the pattern of relationships among the parasites to be sort of a mirror, if you will, of the relationships among the hosts. Well, now we know that, you know, life is never so, you know, so uncomplicated and pretty. You know, what we call host shifting or colony of new hosts does occur, you know, regularly. And so what we actually see when we look at these patterns is kind of historical associations like the scabies mite and humans, and then relatively newer associations that are the result of colonization, okay, so like the scabies mite on dogs, okay, or the squirrel mite, again, coming from or having its closest relatives, you know, not on other rodents, but on bats.
Getting back to mange, how prevalent is mange? Is there any place on Earth where mange or lice do not exist?
Oh, goodness. Well, probably anywhere where people are and where dogs are, you know, you're going to find the parasites. You know, the human scabies does occur in every human population. Like I say, it kind of comes and goes in these waves or epizootics in a particular place. So, you know, I remember, when was it in the, there was a big epidemic in many parts of the world back in the late 1960s, early 1970s. So there were a lot of case reports, you know, it made it into the newspapers. And, you know, then again, it kind of faded away as it does. But that doesn't mean it, you know, it went extinct. It just, you know, went into other populations where, not necessarily urban populations. I had a colleague who was working in Madagascar and you know, had come back and came to see me and showed me a spot on his hand and said, you know, is this what I think it is? And I said, well, probably. Why do you think so? And he said, well, because one of the local people I was working with had scabies. And, well, anyway, there was some handshaking going on and, you know, and he had become infected.
Ew. We've talked some about the physical signs of mange, like the hair loss and whatever else. Are there certain behavioral characteristics that are typical of mangy animals? For example, anything that they do that would be a side effect of the mange that wouldn't be, you know, a physical, you know, that wouldn't be obvious from physical appearance?
Well, they're going to clearly be itchy. You know, they will scratch a lot because, you know, the mites do irritate them. Probably in the more advanced stages, that's going to be less apparent just because the animals are going to be basically too weak, you know, to do a lot of scratching. Mm-hmm. You know, they will, again, in looking at some of these, chupacabra accounts, you know, of the attacking of livestock and the like, because these animals are greatly weakened, you know, they're going to have a hard time hunting. And because we're talking about carnivores here, the dog family primarily, that they may be sort of forced into, you know, attacking livestock because they're easier than running down a rabbit or a deer or something.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what your thoughts are about the media's interpretation of this, what seems like a common phenomenon?
Well, you know, again, it's the combination of myth meets, you know, meets reality. And, you know, as is often the case when myth meets reality, there is a rational explanation for what people are seeing. If the myth is coming out of a population who's ignorant of the medical condition or whatever, I mean, it's, you know, similar to, you know, different, you know, human anomalies that, you know, get, I mean, genetic, diseases and things that have physical manifestations that are, you know, often interpreted in some cultures in, you know, in some sort of mythic way. But it's, you know, I have, you know, I did check, you know, a lot of the pictures that are floating around on the internet of chupacabras, and aside from the obvious paintings and drawings of monsters coming from the imagination, anything that looked like a real animal sure looked like a mangy coyote or a dog or a fox to me.
And just going back to, sorry, did you have a question, Blake? Or?
Well, I have lots of questions. We keep going, though.
Oh, well, I was going to move back to scabies again, unless you wanted to ask.
And who doesn't want to talk about scabies?
I didn't think I'd ever be asking questions like this. Let's go back to scabies for a moment.
Are you all itching about now? I mean, I
wanted to ask you about that. I read a study a number of years ago in a science magazine about the sort of psychosomatic aspects of itching and talking about this topic. What do you know about that?
Well, I laugh because there have been so many, you know, sort of personal experiences with things like this.
Does it affect you?
One of the things I learned early on is to sort of avoid shop talk in a restaurant.
Probably a good idea.
Yeah.
I was at a parasitology meeting once and, you know, was having dinner with some colleagues and just talking about things we normally talk about, and all of a sudden kind of looking up and seeing there was no one else left in the restaurant. You know, we were not actually asked to leave or anything, but it's just sort of second nature to, you know, those of us in the business. But clearly is very troublesome to a lot of people.
Does it affect you or not anymore? You just talk
about it. You know, I've been at this for, you know, 30 years or so and have never actually had scabies myself. You know, don't look forward to the day when I might.
That's excellent.
Okay.
I was going to do that, and I get to save it. Yeah,
that'd be nice. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot, you know, a lot of the head lice, and you know, we've been through that with kids and all this. I mean, that's a completely different story. But and there are, you know, there are other mites that do bother people, and not causing mange or scabies-like conditions, but they just bite, and I deal with a lot of that. And then we get this condition that's called delusional parasitosis, where, you know, people have the feeling that things are, you know, on their skin or biting them that they can't see, and because if they can't see it must be too small, and therefore it must be a mite. Then I get a lot of questions from the public that, you know, again, the first thing I have to tell people is, you know, I'm not a medical doctor, and, you know, I can't diagnose a condition, that if they can actually show me a specimen that's a mite, then I can identify it. And in cases where they can, then we can usually, based on what it is, figure out what the source is. You know, for example, there are parasitic mites that live in the nests of birds and small mammals, you know, rats and mice. And, you know, if the nest is in the house or around the house, and if especially if it's a bird nest and the young birds have left the nest, the mites will come in the house and bite people. And those are the easy ones because, you know, people will bring in, you know, this mite, and I can say, oh, yes, that's Dermatitis gallinae. That's a mite that comes in bird nests, and you just have to find the bird nest and remove it, and that'll take care of your problem. You know, but it's when they come in with, you know, boxes full of hair and you know, pieces of paper covered with scotch tape that they've rubbed all over their body and or, you know, plastic bags inside plastic bags inside plastic bags. It's an item, you know, with a tiny insect part in the last bag. You know, these are people who have kind of let the feeling kind of take control of their lives. And there are websites, you know, that I can refer people to that discuss this. I always, you know, people are always saying, I'm not crazy, you know, or do you think I'm crazy? Okay. And I don't think they're crazy. Of course not. They're obviously having, you know, some sort of sensation. And, you know, the idea is to try to find out what is the source of the sensation. And I try to tell them that there's many things other than, you know, a mite or a small insect biting them that could be causing those sensations, and that they certainly need to see, you know, a dermatologist, right, who can literally, you know, could diagnose scabies or something like that. But, you know, I try to tell people that it's a very common a phenomenon. I mean, I do introduce them to the idea of delusional parasitosis and in an offhand sort of way, not by jumping back and saying, you're crazy. That's the last thing I ever want to do. But to tell them that, There's possible, you know, psychosomatic reasons for these sensations, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that is something that when you're in this business, you just learn how to deal with it, because you are going to have people coming to you with questions about it.
Barry, do you work with dermatologists ever?
Not directly. I do. I work closely with the university hospital here with the diagnostic lab people. I've done some training sessions with them, because they will, you know, somebody comes in with a tick bite and they have the tick. The folks there have been trained to identify the ticks that occur in the local area, because ticks are known to transmit a number of pretty nasty diseases to humans. It's kind of crucial to know what species has bitten you, just in case you start showing, you know, some symptoms. But if somebody's been traveling and they come back and they brought something back with them, then these folks don't know what it is, and that's where I get involved with them and try to pin it down.
You were talking about some of your current research. What's the hot topic these days in parasite research? I have to confess, it's not something that I'm really attuned to. What's cutting
well,
edge
I can,
these days?
You know, I can tell you what we're working on right now. I mean,
yeah, what are you working on?
We're working on house dust mites, which maybe you've heard of. House dust mites are quite fascinating, because the medical connection, it was discovered back in the 1960s that people who are allergic to house dust, the vast majority of them actually turn out to be allergic to the mites that live in house dust, more so than to any of the other components that are in there. And what we're doing is we've actually been able to show that the dust mites have done something almost unique in their evolutionary history, and that is they're not parasitic. I mean, they're living in our houses, in our beds. They live. Other species live in the nests of birds and mammals, and some of them even get in and infest stored food products now. But that their ancestors were permanent parasites that lived on birds. And this idea that, there's an old adage, you know, once a parasite, always a parasite, which implies that in the evolution of a parasitic association, the parasite is basically giving up, you know, its ability to live anywhere but on that host. Okay, so its host then completely becomes its habitat, and you know it adapts to that habitat to the point where it really can't live anywhere else. And you know, certainly not going back to being a non-parasite and living a free living existence. But our work on the dust mites, and this has been done with especially in collaboration with my colleague Pavel Klimov, and we've been looking at DNA from the dust mites and a whole bunch of related mites, both parasitic and non-parasitic mites. And our results, which I'm actually going to present at an international conference here next week in Brazil, clearly show that the dust mites have evolved from an ancestor that was a full-time permanent parasite living on birds. The interesting thing, there's a couple of really fascinating things that have come out of that, you know, with that evolutionary history. And one is that the group that the dust mites are related to are usually called feather mites. They mostly live on the feathers of birds, where they're really innocuous. I mean, they're parasites only in the sense really that they're living their entire life on the host, and they can't generally live off the host. But they're not really doing anything bad to it. Okay, there's a, you know, a definitional problem here that most parasitologists would define a parasite as something that not only, you know, lives on a host, but actually does damage to it. And these feather mites are not doing that. They're not really eating the feathers. Some of them have moved onto the skin, and those are really classic parasites where they're doing some damage there. But the ones that live on feathers are innocuous at the worst, and perhaps even beneficial in some cases, because we know that they'll eat fungi and perhaps bacteria and other things that are potentially pathogenic to the bird host. And you can get really big populations of these things living on a bird that, you know, that the bird doesn't care. I mean, they don't do anything really to try to reduce the populations of these feather inhabiting mites anyway. But somewhere along the line, you know, one of these mites did evolve the ability to digest keratin, which is the protein that makes up feathers and hair, and actually it's what largely makes our skin waterproof, because keratin builds up in our skin cells, and then as they die and they're replaced from below, so we have this, you know, the outer layer of our skin, you know, what peels off, right, when you have a sunburn. That's largely keratin, and it's a protective layer. Keratin is a really interesting protein, because it's a very strong protein. It has a lot of, I mean, we can get into the chemistry here, but basically it's such a strong protein, and that's what makes it great for making stuff like hair and feathers that you know are difficult to break down. So if you think about it, when an animal dies, right, and you know you can watch the decomposition process. You know, what's the last to go, right? The last to go are sort of the bones and the hair or the feathers if it's a bird, because they're the most indigestible, and there are so few animals that are specialized, or even microbes that are specialized to digest that material. Well, somehow, again, one of these mite ancestors evolved the ability to digest keratin, and we have species that now, believe it or not, live inside the feathers, okay? Feathers are hollow, at least the bottom part of the feathers, on the inside. And in there's a couple of species that are known from parrots, and we've discovered quite a number of new ones that are living in both parrots and in woodpeckers. There are related ones living in hummingbirds on the inside of their feathers. And these are clearly eating the feather material from the inside. I mean, they're not eating through it and destroying the feather, because that would not be productive, right? It would cause too much damage to the host. But if you think about a mite that can eat keratin, and you know, and has to disperse by coming out of the feather and you know, getting onto another bird, well, the opportunities for that are, well, sort of from parent to nestling. Okay, if you're in the nest, you can do it that way, or when adult birds are mating. I mean, that's a relatively brief encounter, but so mostly probably this transfer is occurring in the nests. And so if one of these, you know, mites, let's just say, that can eat keratin is in the process of moving from bird to bird, and it falls off, okay, well, that's a bad thing, generally speaking. Because mostly, if you're a feather mite and you really need to live on the feathers and eat feather oil and, you know, microbes and things like that, you're not going to find that down in the nest, right? But if you're a keratin-eating mite, what you do if you fall down into the nest, is find yourself surrounded with food, okay? If you've ever looked inside a bird nest after the young birds have grown up and left, there's all this white, fluffy, dusty material down in there, and all that is pure keratin. And that comes because when baby birds grow out their new feathers, they're surrounded by what's called a feather sheath, and that feather sheath is made out of keratin, and it just sort of sloughs off as the feather grows out and kind of builds up in the nest. Okay, so you're a keratin-eating mite, you fall into the nest, and you don't have a problem with food, okay? So as long as you're able to survive now the temperature changes and humidity changes, and you're able to get back on a bird when it's time to disperse, well, you've set yourself up for possibly a completely new lifestyle. And that's been rather successful, because there are quite a number of species in this group now that are living in nests. Several of those have gotten into human habitations, right? And they live in our homes, and they're eating the same sort of stuff. I mean, they're eating our dead skin for the most part. You know, they can eat other things. They can eat fungi, and they can eat, again, some of them have gotten into stored food products, grains and the like. But they're still kind of doing what their ancestors did. And, you know, to me, the most fascinating aspect of this whole dust mite evolution and the connection to the medical problems caused by dust mites is that the allergists have actually identified well over 20 different allergens, different proteins that come from dust mites that people can be allergic to. But the one allergen that the majority of people are allergic to, and the one that causes the most problems, it's the same one. And so people were wondering what this was, okay? And the early studies actually found that this particular allergen was concentrated not in the mite's bodies, but in the mite feces. Okay, so it's coming out the back end of the mite as they're feeding. And it was suspected that this allergen it's a protein, because that's what allergens are. And the protein, when mites and insects eat solid food, like these mites are doing, and the food is going in their gut, the first part of their gut is lined with cuticles, so it's not damaged when the food goes through it. But when it gets into the part where it's going to be digested, it can do damage to the lining of the gut, right? And so the mite secretes what's called a paratrophic membrane, which is a little soft protein coat that goes over the food as it passes into the midgut where digestion will occur, and then it's taken into the gut cells for actual digestion. So people thought, oh, that's the obvious thing. Okay, it's going to be the allergen will be this membrane that's going to be left over. Again, it's going to stay with the food as it goes through the gut, and any waste material that isn't digested will pass out as fecal material, and it'll be surrounded by this stuff. Well, when they actually looked at the structure of, people have actually determined what the structure of the antigen is, and it isn't a paratrophic membrane protein. It's the enzyme that digests keratin.
Ah.
Yeah. So we have gone full circle here. Okay. So mm-hmm. we've gone back to the ancestors who lived on birds that evolved the ability to eat keratin, all the way through the shift from a parasitic to a non-parasitic lifestyle, to causing problems again, to the humans at least, because of the very enzyme that allowed them to make this transition in the first place.
That's really interesting. So the enzyme that lets them digest the keratin ends up being a problem for the people who cohabitate with their environment.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
That's really amazing. So now we just need evolve not having those reactions.
Right. and in the meantime, we just wrap our mattresses up with plastic. And my son had a bad dust mite allergy, so we had to do that when he was growing up.
Is there a distinction between people who study parasites and those who study how to destroy them?
It's all part of the big field of parasitology. There are certainly many different emphases. There are people like me who really get excited about working out the evolutionary histories of parasites and their hosts. There are people who are more ecologically oriented that get excited about what is it that the parasite is doing when it is living on or in the body of this host. I mean, what is the essence of the interaction? I mean, there are folks who look at this at the molecular level. What kinds of chemicals are being produced that cause reactions or don't cause reactions or prevent a reaction in the host. And that's all really basic science there. And when you get into the more applied ends of things, the medical side of things, where the focus is on treatment and prevention. So you still need to know some of these other things. If you want to know how to not get a particular parasite, you need to know something about its life cycle, where it lives, how it moves, through or potentially moves through different hosts. Then I suppose there are folks who get paid to go out and kill mosquitoes, and that's a good thing too.
Well, just a final question we like to ask our guests. What's your favorite monster?
Yeah, my favorite monster. Oh, my. Let me tell you about a movie I saw a very, very long time ago. It was a wonderful old Mexican horror movie made back in the 50s or 60s called The Black Scorpion. And, it actually featured some rather gigantic arachnids. The title character was this train-sized scorpion. And you know, the folks who made the movie did a pretty good job with it. I mean, it really did look kind of like a scorpion, you know, had its tail and a sting and on big pinchers and all of that. And, you know, it didn't have the right mouth parts for a scorpion. You know, it more had beetle mouth parts, but, you know, I'll give them that. But my favorite part of the entire movie is when this young boy, who is one of the heroes of the story, actually falls down this hole, okay? He's trying to escape something, and he falls in this hole, and he's menaced by this giant mite, okay? And the mite is actually pretty well done. I mean, I can even identify what family it belongs to. It's a group of predatory mites that has very large, what we call raptorial appendages around its mouth parts that they used to grab prey with. You know, he's having to dodge the attacks of this mite. And I thought, you know, that was pretty cool to actually bring a giant mite into a monster movie.
Actually, I was watching that with my daughter about a month ago.
Oh, yeah, really?
She's only four.
Oh.
She said it was too slow for her. She wanted it to watch something more action. But that had special effects.
I was going to joke that you'd seen it, Blake.
Yo, absolutely. I've got it. Yeah, yeah. It's got special effects by Willis O'Brien. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, so there you go. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Well, no problem. Okay.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to Monster Talk. Today we've been learning about mites and lice and the role they play in monster folklore, as well as the science behind their life cycle. We interviewed Dr. Barry O'Connor, an acarologist and evolutionary parasitologist. Your hosts were Blake Smith, Dr. Karen Stolznow, and Benjamin Radford. If you'd like to comment on the show, please come visit the Skeptic Forum at skepticforum.com. If you'd like to help out Monster Talk, please give us a review on iTunes. It's fast, free, and helps us get the show out to more listeners. Monster Talk is produced with the support of Skeptic Magazine. Visit them at skeptic.com. Music from the intro was from composer David Beard. The Monster Talk theme is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. All music is used with permission. The views expressed on Monster Talk do not necessarily reflect those of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society.
For more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
Did you hear about the geneticist parasitologist with Tourette syndrome?
No.
He developed a tick.